From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I honestly wasn't sure I wanted to go down that road because I knew what it would require of me, and I wasn't sure I wanted to chase that tiger's tail.
Actor, writer, and now showrunner Ray McKinnon had an idea for a TV series about a prisoner who walks free after years on death row. Turns out his script sat for years, and when McKinnon got a surprise offer to make the show, he almost said no. Plus, lawyer Neville Johnson represents clients who sue studios over profits. He explains how the late James Garner was an inspiration. But first on the News Banter, Time Warner escapes and still more superheroes. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hey, Matt.
Hi there.
So we talked not so very long ago about the seeming inevitability of Rupert Murdoch and 21st Century Fox acquiring Time Warner. Everybody thought what Rupert wants, Rupert gets. And it turns out, at least not now, not this time.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty surprise development. People thought it was just a haggle over price and eventually there would be a deal. But when Fox abruptly walked away, they basically said that Time Warner had refused to engage with them on any meaningful conversation.
Yeah, I mean, they said it very emphatically, like, we're really serious. We really mean it. We're really walking away, because they're sort of like those, you know, rattlers that you find on the highway and you think are dead. And then when you try to pick them up to keep a souvenir, they jump up and bite you. And people are still scared. Rupert is so scary. They still think he might jump up and bite. But they were very emphatic. And I think the real reason, aside from the fact that Time Warner would not play ball, because I think they don't necessarily want to be bought by Fox on those terms now, is that Fox's stock took a big shot. People were scared Rupert would be overly enthusiastic and overpay.
Yeah, this was the equivalent of kind of taking your ball and going home, because I think that while people were excited for the prospect of the two companies merging, you know, Rupert has been known to overpay for certain assets that he really wants, such
Wall
as
Street
the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a couple of other things. And the people who end up paying for that are the 21st Century Fox shareholders.
Yeah, so Jeff Bukas, the head of Time Warner, seems to have fended them off. Nonetheless, you know, his stock then fell sharply. He actually declined in an earnings call to talk at all about this offer, which was very disappointing to a lot of people because we all wanted to hear what he had to say. He wouldn't do it, but he did talk about the wonderful strategy that they have for growth, including a truly astounding number of films that they're dating, even though they don't have titles.
Yeah, they put 9 DC Comics movies onto the calendar, picking off date by date, saying we're planting our flag that there's going to be about 2 movies a year on the calendar through 2020. And this is in addition to all the superhero movies from Marvel that are there, all the X-Men movies from Fox that are coming, and its expanded Spider-Man universe of movies that are coming. I mean, there's going to be about 7 comic book movies a year in 2016, 2017, and beyond.
I believe 9 actually are scheduled for 2017, 9 superhero movies.
That's insane.
That is insane. Now, of course, we already see that Warner Brothers has tried like crazy to make something work with DC Comics and DC characters. They've done very well with the Chris Nolan Batman trilogy, and now they're entrusting the whole thing to Zack Snyder, and they're going to launch Batman versus Superman. But Marvel has been ablaze, just completely stormed the box office with Guardians of the Galaxy, which many people sort of thought was a test case to see how they would do going into a new direction, a new aspect of their universe. And so far, it looks like Marvel is really winning. I mean, Warner's had to blink with the upcoming Batman-Superman movie.
Yeah, they moved the Batman-Superman movie into March, which is not the traditional corridor for a big, expensive superhero movie. And I've talked to people—
And they did it to get out of the way of another Marvel movie.
Yeah, of Captain America 3. And I've talked to people at Warner Brothers, and the thing that they say about this strategy is that the key to it is making these superhero movies not feel like traditional superhero movies. And what Marvel has been successfully doing over the last couple movies is they've been expanding the notion of what a superhero movie is. Guardians of the Galaxy is not a traditional superhero movie. It's more of a Star Wars-like space opera comedy, even. And, you know, Captain America 2, they positioned more as a espionage thriller rather than a traditional superhero movie. So if Warner's can do that and can make a Wonder Woman movie feel different and a Justice League movie feel different than all these other comic book movies, then people will feel that they're fresh and go see them, I think.
Yeah, somebody out there is going to get hurt with all these movies. But you touch on Wonder Woman, which is another trend going on here. Hollywood studios have discovered the female audience in a way that seems very late. But women did turn out in force for movies like Lucy with Scarlett Johansson and for Guardians of the Galaxy. And so all of a sudden, everybody's trying to patch in women to their superhero world as well.
Yeah, Sony announced that they're pursuing a female-led superhero movie set in the Spider-Man universe. I'm not quite sure what that's going to be, but it's a sign that they are, again, looking to expand the parameters of what a superhero movie is, and because honestly, there's a fatigue that sets in when these movies start to seem the same, and that was the complaint that people had about the last Spider-Man movie, was that it felt like more of the same, and if they can pull off reinventing that franchise with a woman in at the center, even better.
And of course, another problem is that the young boys that they traditionally chased so relentlessly are, you know, kind of hanging out playing video games more, apparently, but not turning out the way they did.
Yeah, if you look at the box office this summer, some of the biggest hits like Maleficent and The Fault in Our Stars and Lucy that surprised studios at the box office, those are all driven by female audiences.
Yeah, women are definitely a new subject of interest on screen, it seems. Not so much behind the camera, not so much in jobs. Studies still show women doing really kind of worse than ever when it comes to directing, but maybe women will actually get to write and produce and direct some of these movies. Can we hope?
You can hope that, but if you look at these movies this summer that have been female-fronted, Maleficent, Fault in Our Stars, Lucy, all directed by men.
Yes, that trend may take a while to break. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. You may know Ray McKinnon as the doomed preacher from HBO's Deadwood, or from his roles in FX's Sons of Anarchy and films like Mud and The Blind Side. But McKinnon is also a writer and director. In 2004, he made a small movie called Crystal with Billy Bob Thornton, a project McKinnon describes as his attempt to make a hillbilly art film. Now he's brought some of that Southern sensibility to television with the Sundance TV show Rectify. The show is what's known as slow TV, thoughtful, almost meditative. The first season covers just 1 week in the life of a man convicted of murder who's released from death row based on DNA evidence. Aidan Young plays Daniel Holden, who after his release appears in a daze at a press conference outside the Georgia prison that's been his home for his entire adulthood.
I'm not sure what to make of this drastic change of course in my life. I'm certainly not against it. Over the past 2 decades, I have developed a strict routine, which I followed religiously, you might say. Now, this way of being didn't encourage the contemplation that a day like today could ever occur, or a tomorrow like tomorrow.
McKinnon himself is also in an unexpected situation, running a TV series that almost didn't happen. Well, I'm going to start out by making a note here that you are, in fact, drinking Ensure.
And coffee and water.
All at the same time here in the studio. And this is because you are, at this moment, what, finishing the last episode of the second season of the show?
Yes, and I think we have worked in the editing room probably the last 60 days straight.
60 days, no break.
Except for the 4th of July.
Yeah, okay. So this is a very consuming thing that you're doing here.
It is for me. You know, that's the only way I know how to approach it. And, you know, you're seeking a certain level of aesthetic that appeals to you. And I want to wring it for every last second that I have in the ways that I can affect the story. And this is the last stage of that.
So this is a show that is a long time coming. You thought of it how many years ago?
I think when the guillotine was still in. In convention, probably I'd say 10 years.
10 years ago.
This story was inspired by real life events. There were a number of cases specifically out of Illinois, 10 years ago.
Right. The governor, I think, eventually just decided maybe the death penalty wasn't such a fantastic idea.
Well, I think he said, you know, if we can't get all of them right, then I'm just not really willing to kill anybody. And that got a lot of attention. And I saw, you know, the men who had been released because of DNA evidence that proved the opposite of what the state's case was, released, and they were saying what they would do on their first night out. You know, it's the typical press conference that these guys get, right?
Right.
And that's intriguing, but I was more intrigued by what the second day would be like and the third day when it really became, you know, all the fanfare left them and they were left with, you know, themselves and trying to understand a world that they'd not been a part of for 10, 20 years.
And it was something that you pitched to AMC, which is, they do Mad Men and Now and Breaking Bad. And did you only pitch it to AMC or did you pitch it around?
I didn't pitch it. I wrote the script. A couple of weeks later, Mark Johnson calls me out of the blue, literally out of the blue. Hadn't heard from him in a year. I think he had my house bugged or something. And he knew that something was going on there.
And of course, Mark Johnson is the producer of many films and television shows, including Breaking Bad.
That's what he tells me.
Yeah, so he says.
You know, and I told him about the pilot, and he read it and said he would come aboard or be a friend of the court or whatever. And so what we did was we gave them the script. We gave the script to a couple of other networks, and they somehow read it that night and made an offer the next day.
Oh, they bought it?
Yeah.
And then they didn't do anything with it?
For a while, yes. I think they were looking at, you know, some larger stories and stories that probably would attract a larger audience. And that was true. You know, that's
They break it to you that it's actually not going to happen for the foreseeable future? Is that clear? Is it limbo for a long time?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I read they were doing the killing, I was like,
oops.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh. There's a similarity here.
A little bit, yeah.
But, you know, that's the way life is. You have disappointments and you pick yourself back up and move forward. And, you know, by the time it came back, I'd for the most part forgotten about it.
So at this stage, Rectify was one of life's disappointments. And then you get a call.
I think it was an email.
Okay. You get a form of communication.
For 6 episodes. And I was at a point in my life where I honestly wasn't sure I wanted to go down that road because I knew what it would require of me. It would require a kind of obsession and commitment, and I wasn't sure I wanted to be consumed by that as I have been by other projects over the years.
I mean, you obviously haven't created a television series before, but you knew from these—
Well, I knew from making movies. I mean, that's difficult enough, and I knew to do a television show, though on one level, it's a great opportunity, but I'm not in my 20s or 30s or 40s now. And, you know, I was just at a point in my life, things had happened in my life and my personal life, and I wasn't sure I wanted to chase that tiger's tail, you know.
Right.
And I wasn't sure when I was in the writer's room. I wasn't sure when we were in pre-production. You know, it was in some ways mirroring the existential ambivalence of my lead character.
You were sitting there staring a lot out the window. What am I doing? Why am I here?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's true.
So an executive named Sarah Barnett at Sundance had read your script, I guess.
I've heard of her. Yes.
Yes, and she
has an accent.
It calls you up or sends you an email and says, do you want to do 6 episodes? Now, initially, I think you had conceived it as more.
Yes.
10?
13, I believe.
13.
Thank God we didn't have to do 13.
Thank God now. But when you get the email, are you thinking, we know you're thinking, do I really want to do this? Are you actually able to say to yourself, well, it's only 6? Or do you think, only 6?
All of the above.
Okay.
You know, I looked at the budget they were talking about, and I questioned whether you could do a television show that I wanted to do at that budget. You know, I think one of the things about the television that we're seeing now, some of the shows that we've seen on AMC and FX and are done at such a razor's edge financially on a budget level, and they're done in, you know, like our show's done in 7 days. We're making literally a half of a movie in 7 days.
Wow.
And it's very difficult to do that. And so I wanted to be sure that we had a chance, you know, at succeeding.
But I'm wondering, having been in that world of HBO, spending is not the issue for them. So when you heard the number from Sundance, did you kind of go like, wow, that's not HBO?
Well, I do think of HBO as the Yankees. You know, it's a different world.
Right. Very different.
But I also realized that this story that I wanted to tell is very, in some ways, narrow.
Contained
and,
world.
And also that nobody wanted to do it. It's, you know, it's they offered a chance for me to do it, and it's a great opportunity. So I embraced the restrictions and we moved forward.
Now, at HBO, ratings are not the issue. Noise is the issue.
Right.
What about at this experience now? Is ratings, do you get pressure? Do you feel pressure about ratings?
I mean, I don't. I mean, this show is what it is, and everybody went in there with, you know, their eyes open. You build it, and people will either come or they won't come. And I just try to make the best episodes that I can make.
It's a very well-reviewed show. It's constantly referred to as the critic's darling.
Well, thank God. I mean, you know, if you don't have the critic's praise and nobody's watching it, it's pretty bleak in those editing rooms.
So the season two, though, you're back for season two. They are giving you 10 episodes for season two. How did that happen? Did you say, I want more, or did they say, we want more?
No, I didn't want 10. It's a story that in some ways I feel is better served in smaller pieces. But that was what they wanted, and so I looked ahead. And in hindsight, I think, you know, we've built a dynamic arc for a 10-episode season.
I mean, did you say, okay, but I need more money per episode, or did you get to have any leverage to say that, or did you have to just do the best you can with what you got?
Well, we found a budget that we all felt comfortable with in the first season. And so the second season, it didn't require a larger budget. You know, you're amortizing as you go along, so in some ways it makes more financial sense to do more episodes, and so that wasn't the issue. The issue was, could you sustain, you know, a story that in some ways is so small, in metaphorical ways it's universal, but could you sustain it for that period of time, that many episodes? That was the challenge, because there's no narrative engine like we're solving a crime every week, or we're going to an ad agency and getting the new account. You know, it's
right.
About a man's
of
journey.
Of course, the solving of the crime is that after the killing, there was so much outcry. We actually had the showrunner on our air, and we've never gotten response like that. And it wasn't pretty. I can tell you when the season one ended and nobody knew who killed the child. But was there any pressure on you to get this thing wrapped up, like whether this guy is guilty or innocent?
I didn't feel any. You know, I was intrigued by telling the story. You know, why do people get wrongly convicted? Part of that is we as a society want to feel like that there's order in our universe.
Sure. We want to feel that we safely put away the bad guy.
Yes. I mean, and so oftentimes what will happen is there's so much pressure on law enforcement to restore order. And
right.
How do you restore order? You find the guy who did it.
Right.
Well, we don't always find the guy who did it.
Right.
You know, people get away with murder. And then so law enforcement sometimes fixates on one person and people get convicted that didn't do the crime. So I'm more intrigued by the man's journey.
Well,
Daniel's
I get that
journey.
You are more intrigued by that, but then there's that thing where the audience also has that impulse to see the crime solved.
But I think that's because they're so conditioned by watching so many versions
closed
of that
end
story.
Procedurals, yeah.
Yeah, so I, you know, that's you know, either they can overcome that or they can't, you know, but this is not that kind of show.
Coming up after a short break, McKinnon reflects on what winning an Oscar has and has not done for his career. And litigator Neville Johnson remembers James Garner as more than just a great actor. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Before Ray McKinnon created the Sundance TV show Rectify, and before he appeared in HBO's Deadwood, he won an Oscar for making a short film called The Accountant. McKinnon also played the title character, a mysterious numbers cruncher lamenting the demise of the smaller, independent farmer at the hands of corporations.
They begin to bombard their new company man with caricatures and stereotypes of himself. Gomer Pyle, Dukes of Hazzard, Beverly Hillbillies, Hey Haw, so on and so forth, till finally he can't trust his own reality. He don't know what it is no more. He starts acting country instead of being country.
When The Accountant won an Oscar in 2002, McKinnon was honored, but that was about it.
I think for those people who really like the film itself, then that was helpful for me in my career. But as far as an Oscar for a short film, it doesn't really mean it. I mean, it would mean more if you had an Oscar for
a longer
picture.
Film. Yeah, I imagine that would help.
Yeah, but I'm not against having it. You know,
you're not going to disavow it.
No, now that I realize I don't have to be the perfect citizen.
Well, did they tell you you have to be a citizen now, Ray? You won this Oscar.
You have to wear a tie everywhere you go.
I mean, this was just a drama inside your head.
Yes.
Okay. So this is an institution that you found in. Potentially oppressive and intimidating.
Well, it's certainly a club that I never thought I'd be a part of, and the fact that they invited me and makes them suspect for some reason.
That's you and Groucho Marx.
Yes.
You don't want to be in the club. So did you do the film purely as a creative exercise, or were you trying to sharpen some skills that would take you into another part of this career?
You know, I can't say that I just did it for the experience of doing it, but I can say that I wanted to make a movie, and now I was pushing 40. And I hadn't made a movie yet.
Did you write the show before or after that film?
Rectify? Much later.
So there was a progression.
Some would say that the reason Rectify is having some kind of success is because I didn't act in it as I had in all my other movies.
But you're not going to show up in Rectify.
I don't know.
Maybe. A little cameo, a little Alfred Hitchcock cameo.
Yeah, yes. Stumbling across the street. What I do best.
Ray McKinnon is the creator of Rectify. The show is in its second season on Sundance TV. Thank you so much for coming in.
And thank you for having me.
Last month, James Garner, the much-loved star of the TV shows Maverick and The Rockford Files, died at the age of 86. Attorney Neville Johnson remembers Garner not just as an actor, but for his impact on the business. Garner was one of the first who had the guts to fight for what he believed he was owed and take on the big studios in court. Even before Johnson came to admire Garner's courage in more than one legal battle, he idolized him on TV. In 1960, a 10-year-old Johnson wrote a fan letter to Garner, and lo and behold, Garner wrote back.
I got back a signed picture, and I always remember what he wrote, which was, "You can never have too many friends. Thanks for writing, James Garner."
So this was long before you became a lawyer, but the same year that you got that autograph from James Garner, he was suspended by Warner Brothers because of a writer's strike, which involved Maverick, right?
And correct.
What happened?
Well, there is a theory in the law called force majeure, which says when an act that's an extraordinary occurs, such as a flood or a hurricane or war, then contracts can be suspended during that period. And they said, well, this writer's strike has caused that. And he said, excuse me, you have all of these other scripts. I could work in any of your other productions. This is not that kind of a situation. And they got into litigation. They had a non-jury trial. The judge ruled in his favor. It went to the Court of Appeal and became a published decision, which means it's precedent and we can rely on it. And he won, and it still stands, and so he didn't have to participate anymore in the making of that show.
And how unusual would it have been to go to court as an actor at that point?
There are actually very few that are on the books up to that period of time of actors who fought a studio. Really, the only one that comes to mind is Olivia de Havilland, who fought in the 40s or so as to her contract, and she won. It had to do with the length of the contract, as I recall. But what Garner did in the 60s, there's really no other similar situation since then. They're quite unusual for him to have done that.
You perceive that as being a man of courage.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was dangerous for him. He was just at the beginning of his career, and it could have been the end of the career. I mean, you know, a lot of people, they say, you're never going to work in this town again. It's true. Many of these actors are viewed as being fungible, and they are.
But Garner wasn't.
No. I mean, he had very good lawyers. He had the top counsels in town at that time, but he proved a point.
So, but James Garner wasn't done. He went back to court 20 years later in 1980 in his Rockford Files days. He had a long legal battle then, suing Universal.
It lasted 9 years, which is an eternity, and must have cost him millions of dollars. He put his money where his mouth was. In that case, Universal had sued Garner because he wasn't showing up for work, and he said, "I am sick." And Garner's position then and throughout the rest of his days was that I never had a vacation during hiatus because I was so beat up because I did so many of my own stunts. And there seems, from what I can gather, there seems to be a lot of truth to that. In any event, Universal said, "No, the reason you're really not showing up is because you're angry about the net profits that you say you're owed." He had a piece of the action, and Rockford had been running 5 years, and 100 shows had been filmed. And when you get to that level, you're in syndication, and you should be making really good money.
Right.
And so he fought back, and he fought hard, and he led the battle publicly against the studio, claiming, "I'm entitled to get fairly compensated." And it was reported that he ultimately settled for $14 million later on.
Which is obviously a win.
Yes.
He went on 60 Minutes, and MCA was, you know, disgusted by this, right? His employers.
You know, MCA has, and still does, now it's Universal, a reputation for being very tough. I mean, all the studios are. And Sid Sheinberg, who was the head of Universal at the time, said, "Look, the guy got paid $5 million and called him a crybaby." And Garner's position was, "Yeah, I'm one of the few who really got into the back end, so can I please have my back end?" But I want to mention to you, I got a copy of a letter sent to me 2 days ago here of the Hollywood Reporter from Sid Sheinberg. And Sid Sheinberg said in his letter, I'll just paraphrase, he said, "You know, I don't recall the exact settlement, but it wasn't in the neighborhood of $14 million."
He denied that, huh?
Well, he's saying that. I mean, I have information to the contrary, and there was public reporting of that. But he also said, "I regret," this is exactly, "I regret referring to Mr. Garner as a crybaby. I am sure he believed in the position he was asserting. I was simply trying to be funny, and on that occasion, at least, I probably failed. I joined Jim's family and fans in mourning the loss of not only a great actor, but a man of high conviction." So that was a classy thing to say.
I agree. So the takeaway from James Garner is what?
That it's okay to fight for your rights. If it's a righteous case, you're not necessarily going to be blackballed or put out of the industry.
But it helps if you're James Garner, if you want to do this and survive.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing about him, he was a charming, affable man. He was a great actor. Everybody loved him. And I think that certainly helped him along the lines to some degree. If you go into court, the judge or the jury is going to be somewhat on your side if they like your persona.
Neville Johnson is a litigator who represents talent in lawsuits against studios. You can read his reflections on the legal legacy of actor James Garner online or in the August 1st issue of The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Melissa Morton. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Maverick is the name.